Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
So the 2013 Smith Lecture is coming up in October. Smith Lecture is a lecture that takes place in Sydney, I think at Parliament House from memory, where a topic of consequence for our community is explored by a leading Christian thinker. And this year they've decided to delve right into the very heart of what the speaker, Professor Patrick Parkinson, is going to call a key moral issue for our time. And look, you'll know Professor Parkinson. He's Professor of Law. He specialises in family and child protection, well known for his community work and also in his work for churches on child protection issues. He was awarded a member of the Order of Australia for his service in the areas of child family law. He was one of the architects, I think probably the main architect, of the change to family law that took place under the Howard government. He is a very, very senior Christian thinker and working in the world of law and families. And Professor Parkinson believes that we must make a response as a church to the challenge that's laid down by the revelations that are coming out of the Royal Commission into Child Abuse. Professor Parkinson, welcome to Open House.
Thank you, Stephen.
So, right up front, you would say that so many people one would meet in the street would say, this reveals the true nature of the church. We're seeing stories, we're hearing stories of institutionalized abuse of kids, not just the abuse itself, but then the process that follows. For that very reason, they might say, I'm not going to set foot in a church. Church is just about hypocrisy. How do we confront that question?
Well, that's certainly a very damning critique, and sadly it's a reasonably valid one, at least going back into the more distant past. I think one needs to put it into perspective a little bit. First of all, it's not just the churches which covered up these things. I think the Royal Commission is beginning to bring out, by exploring the Steve Larkins case, and there will be others, that this did happen across the community. It happened in Scouts, it happened in secular institutions. But I think it was particularly an issue in the church because of the tendency to close ranks, the tendency to want to keep things hidden, not to bring shame upon the church. I think that was a very powerful motivation, which affects any other closed community as well.
Yes, I don't want to diminish even the very point of the question that I asked you at the outset, but I suppose the evidence that we're hearing is that it seems it might be the nature of lots of closed community or lots of institutionalised organisations that they don't like outside scrutiny and have acted in the past, perhaps to try to cover up.
I think that's absolutely right. This is not just a story about churches, but it is. It's also a story about any closed community. Yeah. And we're seeing these things in the Orthodox Jewish community, for example. And I think you'll find it in other closed communities as well.
But Patrick, if that's the case, then shouldn't the church be different from the world around it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it is a shocking history. The title of my lecture is about a moral failure, and there's no question about it. There was a moral failure, not just in the extent of the abuse, as you say, but in the extent of the cover-up. Mm. And no words can express how tragic that was for the lives of so many people.
More so because if the church is to mean anything, then it's the very institution that you ought to be able to trust, because it comes to you suggesting that through the door of the church you will meet the one who will give you eternal life.
Yeah. Let me give you a little bit more perspective as well. I think that the levels of sexual abuse with the Catholic Church are many times higher than in the other churches. And that's an issue which has to be faced. That I've estimated in the Victorian Parliamentary Inquiry that maybe there's six times as much abuse by ministers and religious in the Catholic Church as in the other churches combined, if you're looking at ministers and youth workers and other paid professionals. Now, that's partly because the Catholic Church did so much work in terms of schools, orphanages, children's homes, and priests and brothers were working in that. But it is nonetheless a particularly Catholic story here, and we need to face that and confront it. And I think it has a lot to do with celibacy.
But it must be said that at one stage Cardinal Pell suggested that the Church had followed protocols that you established, or at least that you had reviewed, but there is a disagreement between you and Cardinal Pell at that point, isn't there?
There's not really a disagreement between us individually. I have a great respect for Cardinal Pell, and I would like to think it's reciprocated. The issue was not anything to do with Cardinal Pell. The issue was that in 1996, the Catholic Church made promises to the Australian people that it would turn over a new leaf, that it would be transparent, that it would deal with the offenders, and they would not be given back the power that they abused. And in the second review I did in 2008-2009, I came across some cases involving one particular religious order, and I confronted the Church about that, because these were cases which had occurred since 1996, since those promises were made. And I felt, as a matter of integrity, I needed to call this out. I needed to call for a public inquiry or some other transparent examination of why the Church had failed, apparently so grievously, since 1996 in those cases. These were three cases where men were either moved overseas or left overseas and not brought back when there were serious allegations of sexual abuse against them.
Well, why should people not be very angry? Not just members of the Church, indeed, but others outside. Why should this not be the thing that for a secular mind says, well, the Church is just like or even worse than the rest of us?
I think people are right to be very angry. They should be. This was a very serious moral failure by the churches. I called for that, for the Royal Commission to be established. I was one of many who called for the Royal Commission to be established. But one of the reasons that I felt was there needed to be a point where we can say, it's done, the truth is out. It will never be done for the victims. They will live forever with their pain. But I mean, at least there'll be no more secrets, and that we'll be able to move on as a society. Rather like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, there comes a point where you have to say, let's bring closure and recognize our failures and do a lot better in the future. And the good news, at least, is that I have a fair degree of confidence in the levels of child protection in most churches today.
Yeah, yeah.
I would like to think that with a few, I couldn't say this, for most churches, these matters would be dealt with very appropriately now.
And indeed, it is to be hoped that the Royal Commission process achieves all of those things, recommendations and so on. But in that case, does the Church have anything to lose by showing that it is indeed subject to the judgment, the wrath of God, as it seeks forgiveness?
I think that's part and parcel of being in a society. If we have erred, and we have, then we are subject to the same justice as any other group in the community. That must be so. There can be no special privileges for the churches.
So the way in which the Church responds to the challenge that will be it's going to be confronted with, not only by the evidence, but then by the recommendations of the Royal Commissioners, the way in which the Church or churches respond, that'll tell the story, won't it, about whether we have healthy congregations going forward?
Yes, it will. And I think there will be real challenges in all of this. One of the things that the Royal Commission will need to avoid, and the government, considering its recommendations, will need to avoid, is any overreaction.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can have the pendulum swinging too far in an opposite direction. We need to maintain religious freedom and the integrity and autonomy of churches to some extent. But undoubtedly, we will be different in 5 years' time from where we are now. And most of those changes, I think, will be good changes for us.
Yes, yes, they will. Well, I suppose one of the recommendations we won't... Oh, I wonder whether we will. Well, this is an interesting question. It's going to come up a bit on the program tonight, Patrick. We're discussing a few church-state type issues. I wonder whether the Royal Commissioners will make a recommendation about celibacy.
Interesting question. I don't know that it is the role of the state to interfere with the worldwide doctrines of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church is beyond Australia. Australia is a very small player. But I do hope the Church itself, the Catholic Church itself, will see the need to reform, will look in the mirror with this. Not just the Catholic Church, we all need to, but the particular issues around Catholicism do need to be faced, and celibacy is one of them. Another of them is the tendency to see the Church as a law unto itself. I don't mean that in a negative way, but it has its own canon law, it has its own systems. And I think part of the problem in the past was it wanted to deal with these things in-house rather than submitting to the police and the criminal justice system in the way that we all as citizens should. There are big issues worldwide for the Catholic Church here, and this may be a catalyst, one of many, towards major change. I think the other major change to look at is who is the Church? We are the people of God.
Yeah.
And
so, in effect, the Church itself ought to be angry.
Yes, and I see enormous opportunity here, not just in the Catholic Church, but other churches, which are clerically dominated, for the people of God to take control afresh of our destiny as the Church. There are wonderful lay leaders in the Catholic community, people of great integrity and wisdom, and I think they need to come to the fore. They need to take leadership positions into the future. So these are some of the changes which might occur if we seize the moment.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing more and reading more and hearing that Smith Lecture. I'll give the address for how people can find out about the Smith Lecture in a moment. It wouldn't be wise of me or prudent of me to not have you on the program, Professor Parkinson, and ask you about the relationship between the ACT Assembly, its marriage bill, and the Commonwealth Marriage Act. The Constitution would say, and indeed the territory being a territory, common sense would say, the Commonwealth has the power to overturn the ACT's attempt. What do you think should happen or, you know, can happen?
Well, it's funny you should ask that. I published an article yesterday in the Canberra Times on exactly this issue. Two points, Stephen. First of all, no law in the ACT can be valid if it is inconsistent with the law of the Commonwealth. Now, in 1961, the Commonwealth passed the Marriage Act, and it's very clear that it was meant to be a uniform law for the country as a whole.
Yes.
Now, at the moment, that law says that marriage is between a man and a woman. It also says that marriage is for those who are over 18, those who are not brother and sister.
Yes.
It has various other restrictions on who can marry whom. And it is a uniform law for the Commonwealth. So I think any ACT law must be inconsistent with that national uniform law. That's the first point. The second point is that this bill, which is before the ACT Legislative Assembly, is a dangerous product. And I say that simply as a family lawyer, because if somebody from New South Wales were to marry, okay, so a couple from New South Wales were to marry in Canberra under this law,
yes,
the effect of the interaction between state and federal laws is that they may actually have no rights in relation to each other's property if the marriage breaks down. In other words, they would have far fewer rights than if they had never married at all.
And any children from that in that marriage would be in a perilous position?
Well, the children, the issues are separate, but the financial issues, yes, could be considerable. When a marriage breaks up, when a de facto relationship breaks up, let's suppose it's been going for 10, 15 years, typically there's a claim on each other's property because in a way you're a partnership and the property might be in one name, but you've been a partnership as a couple. Now, if I'm right, I'm pretty sure this is the case, a gay couple who broke up, one of them would not have those rights at all against the other. No right to share in the other's superannuation. And that could have catastrophic financial effects. Ironically, they would be giving up the rights they have as non-married.
Yes, because they currently have those rights.
Yes, they currently have those rights. They couldn't say, well, we're de factos because they're married under ACT law, and as long as that law is valid, they're not in a de facto relationship, they're not in a marriage recognised by the Commonwealth either. So
very
they're in a kind of no man's land, and I think this bill needs to be overturned because it is dangerous to people who won't understand
yes.
the very complex law which will affect their rights. They may think they'll live happily ever after, yeah. and I hope they do. But the family lawyer's experience is that not everybody lives happily ever after.
Well, look, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom tonight. I do really appreciate you taking the time with us.
Good talking to you, Stephen.
Bye-bye, Patrick. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Professor Patrick Parkinson, he's Professor of Law at the University of Sydney, one of Australia's foremost thinkers, writers, experts in the family law, turning his attention there to a couple of the big issues of our time.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.